My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagritz, and we are finally back with the Western Bubble podcast after a two-month break. Today, we're talking about the state of the world after not talking to our listeners for 2 months. It was quite a long time. We apologize a little bit for that, but scheduling conflicts and also just the craziness of the world delayed us a little bit. Balder, how are you after these 2 months of not... I mean, we just had the situation that you didn't know which button to press to record. So how are you feeling after not talking to me for 2 months about this?
Yes, but that might be because of my old age, Dario, that I'm just becoming confused with technology and those kinds of things. Hi, Dario. It's good to be back. Wonderful to be back, in fact. You said just now 2 months without talking to our listeners. I feel that it's like you and I talk. We talk to each other, and our listeners are gracious enough to follow that conversation, right? But it's wonderful to be here again. And it makes sense that today we're just going to talk about the general state of affairs. And then from next week onwards, we'll have more focused topics once again.
Because one of the main talking points we had in the past, well, let's just say 9 months, was that things are happening incredibly quick. And it's very difficult to keep up with the pace of developments. So it would be impossible to do a recap of the last 2 months. I mean, I don't even remember what happened on the 1st of August or last week, for that matter of fact. So we picked two main topics that obviously kind of were dominant in the news, but we also thought would be particularly interesting to discuss today. And the first one is just Trump being Trump. Right, aka the continued slide of US liberal democracy away from us. And the second part is, the second part of our conversation today will be almost a discussion between the two of us, right? Because again, one of the feedback we always get is that we agree too much. And there is a topic that we slightly disagree on, and that is on the European Union simply managing Trump instead of doing anything about him.
Yeah, we need to basically create real antagonism and conflict here just to appease our listeners, to make them continue to be happy, because that's our only aim in life. I look forward to that, because that is a genuine small but genuine difference that we've had during the summer when we did talk to each other without it being recorded. It is also very fitting for the Western bubble, right? This conversation about Trump, this conversation about the EU managing Trump, because these are topics that go to the heart of what this podcast is about, namely the West struggling with a modern world, the 21st century, that it's no longer controlling and it's no longer really understanding the outside world, but it's also having difficulty understanding itself.
Well, let's start with the first of the two topics, which is just a continued slide of US liberal democracy. And in the preparation for this episode, I wrote down three names, and I think we should talk about them, maybe in order. It's Kirk, Kimmel, Comey. And the first one is one that, if we look at it in an isolated manner, it's just a tragedy, right? It's a person being killed by another person, which happens in the United States a lot. Gun violence is one of the major problems. But this particular incident kind of created bigger waves, because the person who was killed was Charlie Kirk, who is a popular right-wing podcaster or influencer, whatever you want to call him, in the United States, who's a big fan of Trump, and Trump is a big fan of him. And that... Of course, if someone like this gets killed out in the public during one of his events, that just creates a bigger reaction out there. However, I was still surprised how big that reaction was. That even in Europe, people kind of took notice of it, right? And there was a protest for him, and then there was an attempted minute of silence in the European Parliament. I was really surprised at the wavelengths we went at to kind of talk about this person, and the fact that we're talking about him now.
So was I, to be fair. I was familiar with him in relatively vague terms. I think I'd seen a YouTube video of him debating people at the Oxford debating club or union or whatever it was. I knew that he was a right-wing commentator, but that was about it. And then if you see the global reaction, not just within the United States, but around the world, the the emotions that his death unleashed took me by surprise. And I think what's happening here probably is not that all those people around the world had posters of Charlie Kirk on their bedroom wall. It is more a matter of Charlie Kirk representing something, right? That then people cling onto and they project their emotions onto his death. But it's basically the frustration out of this world, the search for some kind of answers. And apparently Charlie Kirk was a good symbolic figure for that. Now, when I listened to him in the past, intellectually, I didn't think he was particularly exciting or interesting. But what is clear is that he connected to people somehow, right? He connected to large groups of young people that feel disenfranchised. He was open to debating them, and he got a lot of praise for that. Now, when it comes to the tragedy of someone dying, so the baseline always is it's an enormous tragedy if a 31-year-old man dies, because that's way too young to die, and especially if it happens through violence, that makes it even worse. Now, I personally get more emotionally involved when a child dies in a school shooting, because I find that, you know, that just touches my heart more. But there is no denying that the extra dimension of a public figure being killed, quite probably for what he stands for, is actually incredibly harmful and damaging to liberal democracy, right? To any country, but especially liberal democracy that kind of is based on agreeing to disagree, mutual respect, even if you are on different spectrums, different sides of the political spectrum. And so when a public figure is murdered like this, then that creates a whole new dimension of importance. And it makes perfect sense that we spend time on that and a little bit less time on yet another school shooting, which is unfortunately a regular occurrence in the United States.
One of my thoughts of why this got a much bigger reaction than maybe some other shootings is that it has happened to the right side of the spectrum in that intensity for the first time. And because very quickly, people compared it to, and I should have looked up her name before the episode, but to that Democratic politician from Michigan, right? That she was a member of the House who got shot, right? And her husband as well. And during that time, right, the reaction wasn't as big, despite the fact that I think if you're being shot for, we shouldn't rank the tragedies of people, but if we're looking at a politician being shot, for me, that's just in a liberal democracy, the highest form of escalation, because these people are, right, they're really trying to do something, to change something, right? They're seldomly doing it out of financial interests. They're usually doing it out of personal convictions. I see you kind of shaking your head. I mean, yes, being a politician in the United States pays off very well.
Yeah, I think that was a very European statement of yours, because I think in Europe, being a parliamentarian typically doesn't really pay off much. But in the United States, politicians can earn good money through their job.
Well, and then usually afterwards as well, right? From the context you don't sell out. So, but I think that most politicians get into politics because of their personal convictions and because they genuinely want to improve things. And there, right, having someone attack kind of that virtue to me feels so intensive and like such a tragedy that when I read the headline immediately, right, that actually caused a bigger reaction within me than when I read that Charlie Kirk got killed. Because, I mean, of course, human tragedies, right? Well, let's not rank them. But killing a politician for me is a higher escalation than killing someone who's a podcaster in that sense. And I think it was about, and because when it happened to the Democratic lady, I mean, the right side of the spectrum really didn't behave in nice ways, right? I mean, of course, we should never look at social media in any way, shape, or form, but I think the outrage as a reaction to this killing over the other killing kind of shows that this is one of the first times happening to this side, and that they are kind of not used to it and seeing it as an even bigger attack, right? That how could it be that someone is so deranged, so delusional, that they are actually deciding to kill another person for what they say? Well, again, the other side of the spectrum has kind of had to get used to that fact of life in the United States for much longer.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. There's also sometimes a tendency for us to, not you and me, but for the world to basically act as if both tribes are the same internally, right? Like, hey, it's just two sides of the same coin, left or right, Republican versus Democrat, etc. But we know that the dynamics within the Republican Party, certainly under Trump, certainly the MAGA version of the Republican Party, is simply different in terms of sociology, in terms of the origins, in terms of the way of viewing the world. There's a lot of inherent anger, right? And that's one of the reasons why so many people vote for someone like Trump, not because they necessarily would in any other situation think that Donald Trump is a good guy, but he represents kind of the anger with the establishment. And on the left, there is less of that internal anger, even though you can see that growing on the left as well. But the left typically has always had a more comfortable relationship with, if you like, establishment politics. For whatever reason, we could explore that, but it means that they don't feel that the world is necessarily against them, right? They're not as upset as the MAGA crowd with essentially things going wrong.
By the way, did you notice that the statement I just made would have gotten us taken off the air in the United States if we were on television and the FCC, right, the regulatory body kind of controlling who can send out on television? I think that statement would have gotten us taken off, right, if we were on Trump's agenda. And that's exactly what happened to Jimmy Kimmel, a comedian who hosts a late night show, who kind of said something along those lines, right? I mean, he was factually wrong in what he said. I don't think I was necessarily factually wrong. And that's the second name on our list. It's the one of Kimmel, Jimmy Kimmel, who in a reaction to the killing of Charlie Kirk said something that got Trump so angry that he kind of pressured the director of the FCC to take Jimmy Kimmel off the airs. He pressured Disney and ABC, right? Their parent companies. That was the next kind of slide of liberal democracy we observed in the last few weeks, where suddenly a comedian got taken off for stating his opinion.
Yeah, and if you really listen to what he actually said on that Faithful episode, I mean, there's nothing there, right? There's nothing particularly controversial. I think the most controversial thing he said was something that I mentioned when I spoke to my students about the event, is that you could see immediately sort of the political machinations, the political machine from the White House and from the Republican Party going in full gear and basically milking the death of this 31-year-old man, right? Milking the death of Charlie Kirk and trying to immediately put the blame on the entire Democratic establishment or the liberals or the socialists. There was immediately a lot of anger, not just about the death of Charlie Kirk and not just towards the shooter, who, by the way, we still don't know much about. It is fascinating how little information, factual information, actually has come out. But the anger immediately turned towards the other side of the political spectrum. And that is very much in line with what Donald Trump has been doing consistently, right? Trying to basically punish others for not agreeing with his agenda. And that is bad for liberal democracy. But that was also a very obvious, almost factual observation that Kimmel made. It is completely clear that his cancellation, and now he's reinstated again, but his temporary cancellation had very little to do with the actual words he used, but more because there was an opportunity to do what they wanted to do. They essentially did the same with Stephen Colbert a couple of months earlier, where Colbert is in his last year because his contract is not being renewed next year. Also generally accepted to be in response to appeasing the Trump administration, CBS not wanting to create unnecessary tension with the White House. And so you're seeing a picture emerge of a executive branch that is essentially eliminating dissenting voices, which is the opposite of what a liberal democracy should be about, but especially the United States, which is all built on this idea that everyone should be able to speak their mind, and criticizing the president, criticizing politicians, is a fundamental part of how the system is supposed to work, balancing powers, etc., etc., right? So to see this happen in real time with Jimmy Kimmel, but also with Stephen Colbert, and also with a whole bunch of other people and situations over the past year is terrifying to see. It's horrifying. And if I were an American citizen, I would be panicked out of my mind about where my country is going. And as a European, you know, I'm not that far behind of that panic, because I, first of all, would really like the United States not to slide into chaos or authoritarianism. I would like the United States to thrive, to do really well. And on top of that, I am terrified that what's happening in the United States right now is going to happen in Europe in the next 5 or 10 years.
I don't know if I share that fear. I mean, you're the first one who told me that Europe is usually 20 years behind the United States in those developments. I'm not sure whether I share that particular fear, just because I would hope that the observations we're currently making about the United States are scaring us off a little bit, right? We've had, we recorded that episode a few months ago when we analyzed the election outcomes in Australia and I think one other country, as kind of like an anti-Trump reaction. And another sign of hope I see, maybe it's because we haven't talked for 2 months, and so I'm a very hopeful person at the moment. Let's see in 3 weeks how dark my views of the world will become. My hope is a little bit that more and more voices also on the Republican right, that has been completely silenced and overtaken by the MAGA movement, that they have voiced concern and disagreement. And one of them being basically like a flag in the wind, right? Ted Cruz. Even Ted Cruz criticized Trump for that, right? Honestly, he did it out of self-interest, because he said, well, hey, in 3 years, the Democrats are going to turn this around and use this behavior against us, and that's what we're really concerned about. But there were at least, right, voices that disagreed with what they did. So here I'm taking a little bit of hope out of that, and I'm hoping that maybe Europe is learning the lessons, looking at the United States, and maybe the lessons from World War II, right? Let's learn those.
It is fascinating that we now have to praise Ted Cruz for doing this, because Ted Cruz is not someone who's usually on my praise list.
That's how low we've sunk, huh?
Yeah, you could say even a broken clock is correct twice a day, right? But in this case, this is kind of a big one. And it's at least very good that he spoke out, and I'm grateful for that. I don't think he's a particularly good or helpful politician, but in this specific instance, he is absolutely right. And he essentially, you know, paraphrased Voltaire, right? I mean, I think his words were, if I remember correctly, I hate Jimmy Kimmel. I'm very glad that he's off the air. However, the way that this happened is bad, because if this is the way it gets done, then next the conservatives will be the target if a Democratic president is in office. And you can no longer have this kind of open and free political society, right? Which is like a different version of Voltaire, who said something along the lines of, I disagree with everything you say, but I will fight till the death for your right to say it. So, you know, it's good that there were a few people who spoke out. And it's also so obvious, right? This is not a subjective thing, unless you believe that the United States would be better off as an authoritarian system, as a dictatorship. If that is your position, fine. I mean, then we have a different conversation. But if you believe that the founding fathers were correct, that the past 250 years of the American project were to build up something based on freedom, on free speech, on liberal democracy, if you believe that the United States stands for those things, then it is impossible to feel comfortable with what just happened to Jimmy Kimmel, right? It just is incompatible with believing in the basic foundational values of the United States. And it is almost surprising that there are not more Ted Cruz's, right? That so many people were silent about this. And that's maybe out of fear, maybe it's just indoctrinated tribalism. But you would have almost expected the entire Congress and the entire Senate to stand up as one and say, this is unacceptable. And yet they didn't.
Which nicely leads us over to James Comey, right? The former director of the FBI during 2017. who was kind of leading the charge against Hillary Clinton in her right in when she was on or when he let the basically search into her emails, right? When Hillary Clinton had 20,000 emails on a personal server, which is something you really shouldn't do. And he looked into that. And at that time, he was praised by Donald Trump for his work. But ultimately, I mean, he's just a good, honest bureaucrat who does what he's supposed to do in within the mechanism of the institutions that we have set up in liberal democracies, something that we as the Western bubble think is good. But if you do that, then you're on the bad side of Trump. And so yesterday it happened that basically James Comey is being put on trial because of obstruction of justice and because he allegedly lied under oath. And I mean, we can kind of see that that is politically motivated, particularly because Donald Trump has said for the last few months that he will go after Comey.
Yeah, this is one. This is again a very clear case of that same pattern. It should be said that Comey, over the past few years, I think it was since COVID, if I remember correctly, started becoming more openly critical of Trump. You know, in of his experiences in the past. And then when Trump was elected president, he also tweeted out some critical things. So it was clear that he was no longer, you know, just a neutral bureaucrat. So that's there. But that's exactly the problem here, right? You should be able to voice your opposition to the president without being punished for it, without immediately going on some kind of blacklist. And in many ways, Comey represents the whole transition that we have seen in the United States, right? The first term of Trump was very different than the second term of Trump. Not because Trump was particularly different, but during the first term of Trump, you had those institutions, which Comey was part of, that were still very much a limiting factor to what Trump could and could not do, which is exactly what you want in a well-functioning system. The president is not a despot. The president has limitations. And as a result, he kind of represents those institutions that Trump since then has broken down. The moment that the United States chose Trump as their president for a second term, the moment 75 million people in November of last year voted for him was the moment that they essentially said, Donald Trump, you can start taking down the institutions that you have been ranting about for such a long time, the institutions that have limited you in your first term. And that's exactly what Trump has been doing since then, since coming to office in January. And Comey is basically a real symbolic representative of those institutions that are now falling down, and which scares me so much, right? It is so scary to see institutions no longer being able to stand up for themselves and instead being terrified to offend the Sun King.
I don't know, this gives me shivers. Because the thing is, here I'm thinking about the future. And I'm thinking about what do we do in 3 years' time when ideally the Trump administration is out of office. And then they will be persecuted for all their wrongdoing during this time. Again, it almost seems like this right. I mean, how do you go about this? Because it might then seem like a witch hunt and you're not able to heal. I mean, I said this in at the end of Biden, that I think the best thing Biden could do is simply pardon Trump, because I think that would motivate Trump not to become president again. But here I'm not really sure what to do, because all of this is so politically motivated. And how do you treat this in 3 years when it will be the other way around?
Now, this is incredibly difficult. It's a catch-22 situation, right? You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Because there are some basic principles, like you don't want to pardon people who committed significant crimes, who damaged the country willfully. On the other hand, exactly as you said, if now in 3 years' time the United States votes for a Democratic president, which, by the way, is in no way given, it's not as if the Democrats are, you know, a well-oiled machine that are obviously gonna make use of the weaknesses of the Trump administration. It's very possible that there's gonna be a Republican president who follows down the Trump route during the next elections. But let's say that a Democratic president gets elected, then the moment that they go after Trump, then that will only further weaken any confidence in institutions, because half of the country will feel this is a political vendetta, and they will then cry wolf. They will start saying, well, this is the end times, because the Democrats are now trying to eliminate their political opponents, exactly as we are arguing what the Trump administration is doing. And so, yeah, I don't envy whoever gets into the White House after Trump. It's an incredibly difficult situation, and I don't think there's an obvious solution. The long-term solution is that the United States population, the electorate, needs to start taking their role seriously, right? And that doesn't mean automatically voting Democrats, because Democrats have been also highly problematic in many ways. But what it means is that they put their political tribalism not in front of their love for their country and the institutions, right? The moment a politician on whichever side starts breaking down the institutions that are at the foundation of the United States, at the foundation of what the founding fathers envisioned, at that moment, those politicians need to be punished by losing their votes, by losing their support. Just in many ways, as what happened just now with Kimmel and Disney, that you had this entire counter-reaction to Jimmy Kimmel being fired and Disney losing lots of subscribers, being criticized from all sides, and then reinstating Kimmel because they basically had no choice, because the image that Disney was giving off was terrible. That's the kind of thing that you need from the US electorate to do. We care about Republicans versus Democrats, but we care about something else even more. We care about the well-being of what makes the United States great, which is healthy institutions that balance power in the way that a liberal democracy needs to see.
You know, I'm not a big fan of boycotts or any of these things. I usually think they're rather pointless. But I did cancel my Disney subscription. Particularly because it does allow you to write down the reason why, and I wrote down exactly that reason. I like to believe that I was part of the movement.
We didn't have Disney at home because we canceled it a few months ago, because there's so many options and we don't watch that much television. I have heard this before. In fact, yesterday I was speaking to a student who exactly said what you said. I don't believe in boycotts. It seems that your generation is a little bit more on the side of either you don't do anything or it has to be hardcore revolution, and not believing in the soft power of the voter, the soft power of the consumer, right? And I think this is a generational shift. In the 1990s, in the 1980s, 1970s, there was much more of a sense that you as an individual could make a difference as long as there were more than one. You together as a group of individuals could actually decide to go after companies. You could boycott companies, you could go to manifestations, to protest in the street. And as long as those were big enough, then that would make a change. And so it's fascinating that your generation doesn't believe in that anymore.
I mean, well, again, I don't use Amazon. I refuse to buy at Starbucks, but it's usually just because I don't like what in general they stand for. I seldomly do it over one thing, right? I mean, I seldomly get upset enough about some like an individual event happening, and then I change my entire worldview. This one, but it was also just very convenient and easy, right? All I have to do is not pay 10 euros a month to Disney. Oh, no.
Well, I will say that. I mean, I don't want to rant as if in the past everything was better and people were stronger or anything like that. But it seems that the current generation, also because they feel a lot of pressure from society, people are stressed. People are not in a good place in general. They do look for the comfortable option, right? And they don't like discomfort. They don't like going into the streets and protesting. They don't like boycotting a company that they actually find convenient. There is less willingness to actually make a real effort to basically stick with your principles than before, I believe. And that is in some ways the victory of neoliberalism, right? It's the victory of consumers behaving like consumers rather than individual agents within liberal democracy.
See, it took about 15 minutes for me to rediscover my cynical side. I think the explanation for this is that we are the last generation. I think Greta Thunberg had it wrong, because they called themselves the last generation, thinking we're the last generation that can still change something. Something I observe more and more within my peers, and particularly within the generation that follows, right? So theoretically, I'm a very old Gen Z person. And then within Gen Alpha, I see this even more, that everything is going down the drain. There's nothing we can do about it. Everyone keeps on telling us there's nothing we can do about it. So might as well enjoy the ride, right? I observe this more and more within my peers. I say it jokingly, at least I hope so. But we are the last generation. And I don't think there's anything we can do about climate change, the decline of liberal democracy, right? I mean, the latest example that I have, and now I'm completely deviating from our script here for this, our plan for this episode, because I felt so strongly I had to post about it on LinkedIn, and you know how the two of us feel about LinkedIn, that we are also the generation that has been slapped in the face, because for 15 years now, I've been told that, oh, you will have it so easy on the job market. Don't worry, because all these boomers will retire. Basically, employers will apply to you. And that was the case until about 3 years ago. And I mean, the data backs us up now, right? Where there was a big study done by Harvard with 289,000 companies that are choosing AI over hiring juniors. In Europe, or at least in Germany here, we see the same, where companies are significant numbers are choosing AI over hiring juniors. So I think that is like the last nail in the coffin, where a lot of peers from my generation are graduating now from a bachelor's or a master's degree. They are going into the job market. They are hopeful because all their lives they've been told, yeah, you will have it easy. And now they have it difficult. And of course, there's also just, we've talked about this a lot in the past, there's just less resilience to bad times. Because we've usually grown up during good times, except the fact that we've lived through the economic crisis of 2008, the one of 2012. We've lived through refugee crises, quotation marks, COVID, the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the energy crisis, a war in the Middle East and all of these things. Right? So I think this is a very fatalistic generation that has been created over the last 20 years.
Yeah, that makes sense as an important aspect of explaining this kind of behavior. I mean, just listening to you, the first thing that comes to mind is that the problem started with the previous generation, i.e. my generation and my parents, promising you that everything would be easy, right? Because I there's a strong case, which we've made in previous episodes, that my generation actually had it easier than your generation. I think when I graduated from university, I was never particularly worried about the future. I was never particularly worried about jobs. In fact, we thought that the 21st century was going to be amazing. Everything felt good. But historically, of course, your generation, I mean, if you look at the history of humanity, your generation has it great. You know, compared to my generation, it's not great. But compared to most generations from before, let's say, the 1980s, it is, or 1970s maybe, I mean, it is a walk in the park, right? And so the problem is the promise. The problem is that you were told that everything was going to be amazing, whereas that's just not a realistic scenario.
I mean, one of the worst choices we have to face is, do we get Disney Plus or do we get Netflix, right? I mean, in that sense, no, I agree. I mean, we are living in really good times, but it doesn't feel like it, right? And I think that's obviously the big difference is, it's much easier if you're born in a post-war period, aka the boomers, and everything is tough and you have to work really hard and suddenly, right, everyone works really hard because it's tough and you're kind of going into this period of everything is great and we're fighting for rights, right? I mean, whenever I'm asked which historical time would you like to go back to, I always say the 70s, right? Because it felt like you had some actual impact as a young person. I would love to be part of the student protests. But no, of course, it's different if you're told from day one everything is good. And right, then, I mean, something that I feel like more conservative or something the MAGA crowd will complain a lot about, the participation award generation. I mean, I don't want to get onto that level, but of course, everything is always easy. you're kind of being told everything is great, and then suddenly something is not great. That's what I meant with a slap in the face. And now this generation wakes up and realizes things are not that great. And I mean, I think the reaction of us will, of course, be a big determining factor in whether we are able to prevent the fact that we're the last generation, right, that had it really good, or is every other generation going to suffer from now on?
But that's what makes this conversation important, right? Because there is kind of this fatalism has a self-fulfilling prophecy built in. It basically, if this generation just says, hey, there's nothing we can do, enjoy the ride, and I'm quoting you here, then at that moment, basically, it is the end. then nothing will be done, and the world is basically screwed. Then that means that my son, who is the generation after yours, will face a very bleak scenario. And that's what makes this analysis of what is going on here. Why is this current generation struggling so much? Not just mentally, because we know that mental health issues are prevalent among your generation. Suicides are up, all kinds of horrible things. But also the belief that there's nothing that they can do about it and that they're just consumers in an uncontrollable world. Now, I don't want to sound like a grumpy 85-year-old granddad. For the record, I'm only 47. But there is another aspect to this, I believe, which has been under-highlighted in general, which is that because of social media, because of the internet, because of the lack of slow reflection, reading books, those kinds of things, people are no longer trained to think in just principles, right? Basic principles. So it's one thing to say I practically can't make a difference. For example, I know that my vote for the Dutch national parliament, which I can still vote for the Netherlands, even though I don't live there, basically is meaningless because it's one of 15 million others. And if I vote for a political party, it's only going to have impact if thousands of others vote for the same party, and which means that my vote actually didn't really matter at all, right? So the reason why I vote, or the reason why I recycle, which is exactly the same topic, is not because my little behavior is necessarily going to change the world. It is because there are certain principles to adhere to be able to sleep at night, to feel that you are kind of doing the right thing. And it seems that the new generation has less of a principled approach to that, right? Less of a, if it has no practical impact, it doesn't matter. Whereas I think there is a case to be made that even without practical impact, you still want to take the principled approach. You still want to save the environment. You still want to vote for the right politician.
I really like that second, right? I mean, the second observation about why this generation might be so fatalistic. And it reminded me of another Harvard, I don't think it was a study, I think it was a book, right, on you need to be bored, here's why. I don't know if that was a chapter or if it was a part, if it was the book, but I remember kind of reading that part of it. My generation is no longer bored, right? I mean, we are bored for 15 seconds and we pick up our phone and we are connected to the world and get one dopamine rush after another because we're on social media or something. So we're no longer bored enough to have these moments to reflect and to be principled. I really like this right, this train of the analysis, of the explanation. Because of course, on the one hand, you think everything sucks, right? Because we're also constantly bombarded with how much everything sucks. We've analyzed this on Israel Gaza, where this generation is very exposed to very visual images of the suffering that's happening there, which is something that no previous generation has experienced in that sense, unless they were affected themselves. So on the one hand, you're very much exposed to this and you feel very helpless because you are only one of 15 million people or one of 40 million people in Spain or one of, well, how many voters? I think 250 million voters in the United States. And then the more comfortable alternative is, oh, let me just continue swiping. Let me go away from human suffering. Oh, a cute little cat. Look what the cat is doing. Isn't that nice? Right? Because exactly, you don't read about something and then you're upset about it for the next 2 hours. You watch something, it really scars you. But if you swipe down or up, one second, which way? Yeah, you swipe up on the phone. Then you will see a cute cat that distracts you from all these negative feelings and emotions you could have and all these thoughts you might need to have a principled approach to the world.
Yeah, so maybe principles can only really thrive for those people who have the luck, who feel comfortable enough to adhere to those principles, right? So now we're kind of back to the first thing you said. Basically, you have a generation that feels deeply unhappy, regardless of whether historically it's justified. Historically, it's not justified. It's only justified in comparison to the previous generation, my generation. But there's this feeling, this sentiment of unhappiness, and because you are uncomfortable, you look for comfort, and principles get in the way of finding that comfort. So you forgo principles and you just order from Amazon, not you, but everyone else just orders from Amazon. They keep their Disney account. They don't go to vote because all of that is more hassle and you already have enough on your plate, right? Basically, that's what's going on then.
Okay, Balder, now we need to quickly talk about the European Union and the United States. I think we got caught up in this. But let's talk for 5 minutes about it and let's see whether we might have to do a little extra episode on this or talk about this in the next episode. This is connected. This is connected to an episode we did a few months ago, where we basically said that the EU needs to stand up to Trump in the United States, and this was particularly in the response to the Trump tariffs. So we recorded this episode in August of 2025, so of this year. And you said, the EU needs to stand up. We need to have a harsher, more intense reaction, similarly to the reaction they had on the military, right? Where, I mean, we both agreed during that time that, yes, the EU needs to spend more on the military now in the short term to basically free itself of dependence on the United States and then hopefully go back to lower spending because you don't need to spend that much money. There's no threat out there. Okay, there's a basic threat level to which you need to have basic defense, but let's not go above that. And then 2 months later, when we talked about the tariffs, we actually disagreed on disagree is a strong word. I don't really have a finalized opinion yet. But we disagreed on basically taking the same approach again, right? To spend a lot of money now and basically stand up to the bully instead of kind of trying to manage Trump's expectations. One of the big criticisms of this podcast is that there's only managers out there, no longer politicians.
Yeah, and the argument that I put forward was in some ways similar to the defense issue, even though the defense issue was more about Europe being not reliant on the United States, right? That's the key component. It's not healthy for Europe in the long term to be reliant on defense mechanisms that are controlled by the United States for a lot of reasons. We want good relations with the United States. We would love the transatlantic environment to be a happy, healthy, productive one. But Europe cannot have a situation that they only operate based on the goodwill of the Pentagon. That's just not healthy. In terms of the tariffs, there's something bigger than that going on for me. The argument is that if Europe does what it actually did, unfortunately, the von der Leyen's of this world decided to basically manage the situation, to not ruffle any feathers, to basically let Trump bully Europe into some tariffs and kind of to say, okay, you know what, you're stronger than us, we'll accept it. The problem with that is that Europe needs to look ahead to who it wants to be in the next 30, 40 years. And the future for Europe, geopolitically, is not one as the lesser partner of a transatlantic union. It's just not going to work. Europe needs to have a voice on the global stage where it is seen as independent from the United States. And if Europe were to say, look, we're not accepting any tariffs, yes, that would have some short-term practical implications that might be painful, but in the long run, it would create an identity for Europe, where Europe is seen by India, by China, by Russia, by Sub-Saharan Africa, by Latin America, as an independent voice that they can do business with without having to go through Washington, right? Unfortunately, that's not the choice they made. They surrendered to Trump. They said, oh, yeah, okay, we'll accept some tariffs. You win. Congratulations. We're afraid of you. And that means that Europe is rudderless. Europe has no identity, doesn't know where it's going. And I believe that the European population will not appreciate that in the long run. It will make people even more upset with European politicians because Europeans don't know what they stand for. They don't know who they are.
See, the good thing is we agree on on the status quo, and we agree where we would want to go, right? So I absolutely agree that if we continue like this in 20, 30 years, Europeans will be very unhappy. I think most Europeans already are unhappy about that. I also am a big fan of let's have a vision, right? I think I've said this very early on in this podcast, is why don't we have any visions, right? Why is it only about, oh, the election 2029 instead of a vision 2030, 2040, 2050? Where do we want to take society? Where do we want to be in these years? The only problem I see with this is, well, I mean, I would like to get there, and I know it's difficult to get there without a, like, I would like to get there without a heartbreak, right? Without properly standing up to Trump and saying, well, until here and no more, because that's going to create a trade conflict that I think after COVID and after the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the resulting gas crisis, I think the political capital and I think the capital are no longer there for European leaders to say that and to stand up to Trump. Because what happens if he puts 30% tariffs on trade? Right. I mean, then we can say goodbye to large parts of the industry and a lot of companies out there. And I'm not sure whether we have that money to kind of compensate these companies for that.
Now, I don't accept the premise that that is automatically going to be the result. Right. If you look at Trump's behavior in the past, in some ways, just like a classic schoolyard bully, if you actually stand up to him, he often gives in. That this is exactly what happened with a number of countries with tariffs. But also on other issues. He backs off if it turns out that people do not fulfill his wishes. He threatens, he huffs and he puffs, like the wolf with the three little pigs. But once he actually reaches a sturdy house, he gives up. He doesn't continue. And that is something that I think is actually a more likely scenario that could have happened than a horrendous trade war that would have led to economic bloodshed on both sides, because it would also hurt the United States, to be clear, right? It's not just Europe who would get hurt by that. Now, however, even if that was the scenario, even if Trump wouldn't back off and would have insisted on going into a bloody trade war, then still that would have been preferable, because at least what that would have done is it would have marked the identity of Europe, where it basically tells the rest of the world and itself, just as importantly, we are no lackeys of the United States. The Cold War is over. We are grateful for the United States protecting Europe against the Soviet aggression, Western Europe against Soviet potential aggression. That's no longer the case. We are now an independent actor that would love to work productively with the United States. We would love to come to an agreement, but it has to be an equitable agreement. It can't be us being bullied as if we are the lesser partners in some kind of eternal union. And if that had led to a couple of years of relative economic hardship, I don't think we should exaggerate the impact that it might have had, but that would, from my perspective, been a price worth paying that Europe would then indeed have to manage and would have to make sure that people who lose their job as a result get taken care of. Of course, it leads to difficulty, but it is a difficulty that can be managed and that is worth the cost, because otherwise the long-term picture is getting bleaker and bleaker, and in the long run, more and more people will suffer.
I agree that, right, this is not the definite scenario that would happen, right? I mean, of course, I can't look into the future. I mean, I see the development between China and Trump. And, I mean, yes, of course, they didn't end up at 250% tariffs, but they still end up significantly higher than before. But the problem I see here with the argument of saying, well, we should endure a few years of economic, hardship, because I've already seen what 3 years of stagnation can do to a country. And that's Germany, right? So, and I might be slightly biased because I work close to the German industry. And I now, particularly in the last year, kind of see the effects of what happens to the industry after 3 years of stagnation. You have to make very uncomfortable choices, right, about employing people and so on. I mean, I do think that if company leaders, if managers were more courageous, they would simply say, well, we're going to continue to keep our people on. I think that would be the fair end. But I mean, I already see what this, what kind of the economic hardship of the last few years has done to this country. And that is the Alternative for Germany currently being the strongest party in the polls, right? At 25%, stronger than the Conservatives, stronger than all the other parties. And here, I mean, yes, of course, we can use more money to kind of cushion the effect. But at, I mean, at, until what point does that go well? So that's, I mean, I'm not saying that, hey, we shouldn't do this. My main point is that I can understand current politicians who are hesitant to take that route, because it has been really difficult during COVID to pay that bill, and it has been really difficult during the energy crisis as a result of the sanctions on Russia to pay that bill as well. And so I'm not sure whether the current social fabric and whether the current substance of European states and governments is enough to also cushion the effects of a trade war with the United States, because there the dependency of the economies on each other are even worse. And I think we can already see in the United States how bad things will get, right? If you have to suffer under these tariffs and under a downturn of the economy, and how much worse it will make the people off.
Yeah, I think it's good to once again emphasize, at the risk of being repetitive, that we are now talking about a scenario that we don't know for sure if that scenario had happened. We don't know if it would have led to a bloody trade conflict. Also, I do not in any way want to belittle or minimize economic damage, right? I mean, economic downturn, especially if it's badly managed, especially if it is by politicians who don't really have a clue of what to do, can be horrific, and it can affect enormously already vulnerable groups within society. So I'm not taking any seriousness away from that. However, I also think it is kind of disingenuous to blame the rise of the AfD on the economic downturn. Because, first of all, the AfD was already on the rise before economic downturn. And it is on the rise in countries that haven't seen, not the AfD, but similar parties in the Netherlands, in Spain, in all kinds of countries that don't see that economic downturn. So I understand the arguments, but I don't think that the key problem of why the extreme right is on the rise is economic downturn. It is politicians not actually having answers to what they want with the country. People feeling lost. Your generation, the conversation we just had about the young generation, not knowing who we want to be, where we're going, not seeing a future. And appeasing Trump in this way is just another way of postponing those big decisions about where you want to go. If people heard from politicians a clear agenda, a clear plan, this is how we're going to get out of the swamp. This is how we're going to get out of the problems we're facing. It's going to take 10 years, it's going to take 20 years, but we'll get out of it. People will respond to that. And just trying to manage the decline, not ruffle any feathers, and making sure that things don't go, you know, too dark too quickly without having an answer, is just not good enough. It kind of reminds me, I don't know to what extent you're familiar or listeners are familiar with them, but it's about, it reminds me of the abundance Democrats, the Ezra Kleins of this world. Those people, Ezra Klein is probably the best, or if you like, the worst example of this, is those people who pretend that there doesn't need to be any substantial change within the system. There doesn't need to be any substantial change in how, in the case of Klein, the Democratic Party does things. There doesn't have to be a change in the way we look at our country. It is just about trying to be the reasonable ones. And I put reasonable in quotation marks here. Just playing the game politically more cleverly. It seems that von der Leyen goes to bed at night thinking, have I been clever? Instead of, have I provided an actual answer and an actual vision? Appeasing Trump is not the answer. It only makes things worse.
I mean, that one we agree on. I mean, it would be really interesting to have basically hours to discuss policy, right? What to choose now? Because I think we very much agree on the utopia that we would want to see at the end. But how to get there and how to, I mean, for me, the conversation would always be about how do we cushion those effects on there? Because I think that conversation is not sufficiently had out there, right? We didn't have that enough during COVID. I mean, when the two of us mostly spoke about, hey, yes, COVID is bad, but you're really ruining a lot of things right now, and we're seeing this. And during the sanctions against Russia, right, leading to the energy crisis, it was also about that. It was not sufficiently cushioning the effects on the population, because I do think that that actually a lot of the rise of the right is due to that, because we know that they have a certain base following, but that it's ultimately, to quote Bill Clinton, right, it's the economy, stupid, right? It's people looking at themselves and looking back at 10 years ago and comparing when was I better and when not.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly an important part of it. And I think that management thing, the question about how to manage difficult situations could also be applied, just what you said, to the immigration situation, right? Instead of this weird relationship that we have with asylum seekers and refugees and immigrants, we should have a serious conversation about what do we want to be? How can we manage this in a good way that doesn't cost too much money? And that, so that conversation about in itself about how to manage situations is fine as long as it is within a bigger vision of where you want to go. And I think that is what is lacking in the European Union, and the European Union is going to pay a very high price in the future because of that. That lack of vision means that they're just trying to minimize the damage in the short term, and as a result, they make the long-term problem infinitely worse.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation. If any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I chose a short quote from Kaja Kallas, former Estonian Prime Minister and currently High Representative of the European Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. Try to put that on your business card. This is a quote that she used to explain why Europe and Ukraine should not give in to Putin and Putin's invasion to Ukraine. But I think if she was consistent and the European Union was consistent, they would apply exactly the same thing to the current attitude of the White House, the Trump administration towards Europe. And the quote goes, "If aggression pays off, aggressors will take note."